if this report comes back and the men and women support it and it is concluded that in fact it does not harm our preparedness, our readiness, I think it's time to eliminate the policy.
Senator Murkowski says she may vote to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 22nd of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, calls for changes to the Coastal Zone Management Program.
After that program was taken out of the state, we had absolutely no voice.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by
Fire Island Wind, offering a renewable energy alternative to natural gas for South Central Alaska. Information at fireislandwind.com.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is in the center of the debate over the military's policy banning openly gay service members. Don't ask, don't tell. Comments she made last week to an Anchorage TV station suggest she's one of only a handful of Republicans saying they'd vote to repeal the law. MSNBC anchor Rachel Maddow jumped on the story Thursday.
We do have some breaking news for you tonight on the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. An Alaska television station, KTVA, scoring a scoop, a declaration in an interview to be aired in Alaska tonight from the senator who looks to be possibly the deciding vote for repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
But Murkowski's spokesman says the senator is not guaranteeing she'll vote to repeal the ban on gays in the military. Instead, she's waiting to see the results of a Pentagon report coming out next Tuesday and wants to see how Democrats in the Senate introduce the repeal legislation. The Pentagon report will weigh in on the impact of throwing out Don't Ask, Don't Tell and includes surveys with service members. Initial leaks show the report indicates that allowing gays in the military will not cause major disruptions. Murkowski told KTVA anchor Matthew Felling that she's concerned about three areas: troop support, morale, and recruitment.
I recognize that we have lost many good men who are within the specialties, particularly when it comes to the language specialties, because of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. I think that that hurts us in our efforts to be the best that we can be, to be responsive. So I think it is fair, it's legitimate to look at this policy. And if this report comes back, and the men and women support it, and it is concluded that, in fact, it does not harm our preparedness, our readiness, our ability to recruit, I think it's time to eliminate the policy.
But even as the national media pointed to Murkowski's comments on KTVA and pegged her as one of only three Republicans willing so far to side with Democrats, her staff put out more cautious statements. The language changing Don't Ask, Don't Tell is in the Defense Authorization Bill, and Murkowski says Democrats should not rush its passage. She's calling for deliberations and discussions on the Senate floor, something Democratic leader Harry Reid may not want to take much time for, since he'd like to see the bill pass next month during the brief lame duck session. Murkowski told KTVA's Matthew Felling on Thursday that Republicans must be allowed to introduce amendments to win her approval.
In order for us to get to the defense authorization bill, that's going to be an initiative that will require a fair amount of floor time. If Reid does not allow amendments to that bill, I think it's doomed to fail.
One of the other hot items being pushed by both Senate Democrats and the White House right now is the new Strategic Arms Reduction, or START, treaty, which is the nuclear arms pact with Russia. Treaties need the support of 67 senators for passage, and President Obama wants to see it pass before Democrats lose seats in January. Murkowski's spokesman says the senator has not yet made a decision on whether or not she'll support it during the lame duck session. In the past, Murkowski has said that other treaties, including the Law of the Sea Treaty, which she supports and believes will help Alaskan interests, as well as better position the U.S. as an Arctic nation, can't move forward until START is dealt with. The outcome of Alaska's U.S. Senate race is in question again. Republican candidate Joe Miller filed a lawsuit in state court today alleging that elections officials broke state law in the way in which they counted write-in ballots. The latest legal challenge comes as a result of a federal court judge's order. Judge Ralph Beislein refused to hear Miller's complaint against Alaska Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell and the State Division of Elections in federal court last week. Beislein said it was a state matter, but did order the certification of Alaska's Senate race halted if Miller were to file a lawsuit in state court by today. Beislein said the results of the race should not be certified until the legal issues raised have been fully resolved. Miller's suit claims the State Division of Elections has not correctly interpreted state election law by accepting write-in ballots that had misspelled candidates' names on them. But Lieutenant Governor Campbell says voter intent drives ballot acceptance. Election officials accepted ballots with misspelled spellings of write-in candidate Lisa Murkowski's name. Judge Beislein has issued a temporary injunction against certification until the dispute is settled in court. The Division of Elections wants to certify the Senate election by November 29th. Beislein says Miller raises serious issues about state election law because Alaska law says a write-in candidate's name must appear on the ballot as it is spelled on the Declaration of Candidacy. Lisa Murkowski has claimed victory in the election. The Republican Party of Alaska has urged Miller to concede. Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson officials said Friday that Air Force fighter pilot Captain Jeffrey Haney died when his F-22 crashed north of Anchorage last week. Searchers located the wreckage of the plane about 100 miles from the city, south of the Denali Highway. Officials say Captain Haney was apparently killed in the crash, although his remains were not found. They say they found evidence indicating that he could not have survived. A memorial service was held today at the base. At the request of the family, it was open only to family members and base personnel. Icy roads have made travel treacherous and resulted in a slew of accidents on Alaska roads as warm weather and rain push across the region. Alaska State Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says the ice has made for a busy day for public safety officers.
Just about everywhere from the Fairbanks area all the way down through South Central Alaska, troopers are consistently, repeatedly responding to vehicles in distress and minor collisions.
Peters says no fatalities had been reported as of lunchtime. State Department of Transportation spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says maintenance crews are out trying to increase traction by hitting roads with a mixture of salt and sand.
These are the conditions that we can use that. It's salt's only effective until just about 20 degrees, and so obviously as warm as it is out right now, we can use salt and it's still effective.
National Weather Service lead forecast in Fairbanks, Rick Toman, says roads retain cold and quickly ice up as rain hits them, but that air temperatures hovering at or above freezing should prevent trees and power lines from picking up heavy ice. Typical wintertime warm-ups are dry in the interior as moisture is pulled from warm air as it rises over the Alaska Range. But Toman says the current system is very unusual, setting up the region for a rare winter soaking.
High pressure in the North Pacific and a southwesterly flow aloft, so it goes around the Alaska Range, doesn't get Chinooked out. But this flow is originating so far south, actually in the subtropical Pacific, coming due north into western Alaska and then around the mountains, bringing extremely warm air and extremely moist air mass for this time of year right over top of us.
Toman says the system is affecting almost the entire state, except for along the Yukon Territory border and the southeast panhandle, where it's cooler and drier. He says the deep southerly airflow hitting the rest of Alaska is not typical of the current La Nina pattern. Freezing rain advisories are posted from the Kenai Peninsula to the North Slope. Governor Sean Parnell's office directed state employees to stay home if they were not already at work. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, going high tech to keep language alive.
A lot of young people are always on their phones, their computer. So what we're trying to do is make Inupiaq language more accessible through technology.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
State revenue sharing, education, and local involvement in regulatory and development decisions are among the Alaska Municipal League's top priorities for 2011. The AML Board of Directors held its annual meeting Friday in Juneau as part of the group's local government conference. President Hal Smalley says AML will ask the legislature for a one-time increase in revenue sharing. The program divvies up state oil tax money for communities, but for the last couple of years, funding has been flat.
It's 4 years it's been in place now. The newer program has been in place. There's been inflation, cost of living increases, and so what we used to purchase with those same dollars is costing considerably more.
Smalley is a member of the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly. He says many municipalities rely on revenue sharing to balance their budgets.
The three biggest expenditures in our particular borough are schools being number one, sanitation being number two, landfills, and then roads. But in other communities across the state, it's basically what keeps their municipal government afloat.
The board also passed nearly 20 resolutions taking positions on state and federal issues, mostly aligned with AML's priorities. One resolution called for changes to the Alaska Coastal Management Program. Former Governor Frank Murkowski did away with the program's Coastal Policy Board, which gave citizens a voice in development decisions on Alaska's coastlines. North Slope Borough Assemblywoman Adeline Hobson says that hurt local communities.
After that program was taken out of the state, we had absolutely no voice. There was no way we could issue comments on any projects that were happening that may interfere with whaling, fishing, and all our subsistence needs.
AML wants the legislature to reestablish the board. Two bills introduced last session would have done that, but failed to get much traction. The Parnell administration is content to go without the board as well. The Municipal League represents more than 140 Alaska communities, covering about 97% of state residents. A streak in the sky that could be seen from Kodiak to Homer at dusk Friday was a multi-stage Minotaur 9 rocket. The joint NASA Air Force research mission successfully lifted off from the Kodiak Launch Complex on Narrow Cape and comes at a crucial time for the Alaska Aerospace Corporation. KMXT's Jacob Resnick reports.
T-minus 5, 4, 3,
here we go.
2, 1, ignition. We have liftoff of the Minotaur 4 launch mission.
At 4:25 p.m., the Minotaur 4 rocket, it's a reconfigured ICBM missile, lifted off at dusk, its contrail snaking upwards, the backdrop a nearly full white moon hanging in a cloudless sky. Minutes after the launch, there was a jubilant atmosphere as each of the four stages separated. Alaska Aerospace Corporation's Chief Operating Officer Tom Case stood outside listening as mission controllers reported all was going to plan.
The launch had all appearances of being completely successful. I got off the pad very expeditiously, just like planned. All the data reporting reports we hear on the countdown broadcast show nominal performance, which is the way it should be, and so everything's on track.
Inside the control room, officers from the Air Force's Space Development and Test Wing watched as the rocket achieved its polar orbit. Lieutenant Colonel Kent Nickel from Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico was the deputy mission commander.
So far, so good. We fairly nominal count. So far, we've gone through all the events on schedule.
We basically have deployed all the satellites at this point.
The fifth stage was a reported success, and the Kodiak launch became the site of the first time a Minotaur 4 rocket was able to send payloads into two separate orbits. Earlier in the day, representatives from NASA's Ames Research Center in Silicon Valley in California signed a memorandum of understanding with the Aerospace Corporation, pledging future cooperation. While the document doesn't specifically guarantee future missions, both sides say the agreement will streamline the ability to collaborate in the future. Ames Research Center Chief Pete Warden said the Kodiak facility is well suited for developing niche in satellite technology.
This launch complex is ideal for launching small, low-cost satellites, and we're now into something called a CubeSat, which is a thing, not much bigger than my fist. It weighs about 2 pounds. And the price of making these things is down to a few $1,000s or less. But just putting a satellite in space isn't the whole story. You need to have a network on the ground so that you can communicate with it. And we'll be working with educational institutions across Alaska.
This $170 million mission comes at a crucial time for the Alaska Aerospace Corporation, which hadn't put a rocket into orbit for nearly 2 years. The state-owned corporation has seen a reduction in federal funding, which was compounded by the loss of its missile defense contract this year. It was forced to appeal to the state and received $4 million from Juno to pay the bills. In recent months, it's emerged that the state-owned corporation is negotiating with the governor's office over a long-term funding commitment. Details of the proposal haven't been released, but Aerospace Corporation officials have confirmed they are mulling an expansion into launching larger medium-lift rockets. That would cost upwards of $80 million. The corporation is also asking for a reported $10 million annual commitment for the next 4 years. Observing Friday's launch was Lieutenant Governor-elect Mead Treadwell. He confirmed that the corporation is asking for as much as $120 million from the state over 4 years, but he says the deciding factor will be the strength of the corporation's business plan in attracting federal dollars and private investment.
The advice that I've given the board of this ever since I was on the Science and Tech Foundation when we started, made the first $25 million investment here, is show customers, show the prospect of customers, show what will get you customers. And I think Alaska needs to understand that when we work to compete in world markets and we get all behind it, we've got a better shot. So that's what I'd be arguing for.
Meanwhile, Air Force and NASA say the satellites are functioning. Of the 16 experiments, 11 have a specific military function. They range from developing a solar sail that would allow satellites to maneuver in orbit, astrobiological tests measuring bacterial growth in microgravity, and the effects of space weather on orbit-to-ground communications. The next mission hasn't been announced, though aerospace personnel have talked about a mission as early as June or July next year. On Narrow Cape, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Federal health officials say a diabetes education program targeting Native Americans is a success. The five-year demonstration project, funded by the Indian Health Service, inspired patients to get more exercise and eat healthier food. That lowered risk factors for tribal members who have the nation's highest diabetes rates. A Southeast Alaska health organization is part of the program. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
Most of us have heard about diabetes and the health risks it poses. But at times, myths and misunderstandings discourage those who might otherwise seek help.
Some people think, well, if it runs in their family and they're at risk, they just assume they're going to get it.
Kathy Dennis is a health educator with the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium in Juneau.
And some of them are surprised that anything can be done to hold off or prevent diabetes. So it's a lot of our work, getting that information to the people that are at risk.
Dennis is one of the search staffers involved in the Lifestyle Balance Program, which the Indian Health Service funds in several Southeast communities. The program targets pre-diabetics, those at high risk of developing type 2 diabetes. That's a different condition than type 1, which is less common but harder to avoid through lifestyle changes. Both involve problems with insulin, which affects how the body handles and stores sugar. Dennis says one of the first things the program does is explain what each patient's blood test results mean.
So that's always an eye-opener when they see that, because a lot of them aren't aware of their numbers from lab.
Patients commit to an intensive 16-week program focusing on healthy eating, exercise, and stress management. They meet in groups and also get individual counseling.
If they're having a struggle in a specific area, the lifestyle coach meets with them on a monthly basis when they're attending classes. So hopefully with this close communication and connection, they're able to overcome some barriers that they had struggled with by themselves.
She says most people complete the program and are able to stop or slow the progression of diabetes. Similar results have been reported nationwide through programs developed for tribal members. The consortium also uses other approaches to diabetes education and prevention. Those are being highlighted this month through a variety of activities. Renee Matheson, a Search Health educator in Sitka, is working on a digital storytelling project. It's training people to share their own experiences with diabetes prevention or control.
The best way is for people who have already gone through the battle and have learned some lessons. If they share it rather than me sharing the information, the message is a lot stronger and people believe them.
Some people need significant changes to improve their health, but Matheson says others are surprised at how little they have to do.
It could be something like asking them to give up one soda a day. It could be asking them to add 5 minutes of exercise onto their lives.
Diabetes is a life-threatening ailment, which can contribute to heart disease, kidney failure, and blindness. Still, Matheson says some are unwilling to make changes until the ailment has begun causing damage.
There are people who deny it and maybe end up with some type of life-threatening event. They may have to have something amputated before it really hits home that this is something that they need to stop and take care of themselves.
Those concerned about diabetes or interested in programs can contact local search offices, public health clinics, or private doctors. The state and federal governments also offer information through pamphlets and websites. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Hundreds of people from across the North Slope gathered at the Inupiat Heritage Center in Barrow for the annual Elders and Youth Conference last week. The emphasis this year was on new technologies to promote learning the Inupiaq language. A trial version of the upcoming Rosetta Stone software for Inupiaq was used for the first time at the conference. Jake Neer from KBRW has the story.
Puttick Glenn is the center's museum and cultural affairs coordinator. She says the event's core is promoting the Inupiaq language.
This year's theme is Roberta, Let's Speak in Inupiaq. And at this conference, what we do is we have elders from all over the North Slope and youth from all over the North Slope, as well as some Inupiaq language teachers, come together to talk about learning Inupiaq language and the issue of where it's at right now and where it can go.
This year, Glenn says, new technologies are being implemented to promote the traditional language to a new generation.
A lot of young people are always on their phones, their computer. So what we're trying to do is make Inupiaq language more accessible through technology, and maybe that could be a real good way to save the language.
The Elders and Youth Conference is organized into a schedule of workshops all centered around the Inupiaq language and other traditional activities like food preparation, games, singing, dancing, and storytelling. Many of the workshops, focusing especially on Inupiaq, involve some sort of computer interaction. One of the highlights of the conference is the introduction of a trial version of the upcoming Inupiaq Rosetta Stone language learning software. The product is nearing completion after nearly 2 years in development by Rosetta Stone as part of their Endangered Languages program. Craig Spaulding is the project manager for the company's Inupiaq North Slope project. He says elders and youth students are some of the first to see the software take shape.
This was the first time that all the parts started coming together, the photos, the audio, and the text. And so this was kind of a preview for the community here to see what's coming first quarter of 2011 when the project is completed.
Rosetta Stone uses what company officials call the dynamic immersion method of teaching languages. According to Spalding, the system doesn't use traditional translation of words from a first language to the language being learned, and instead uses images, text, and audio to build context. The aim is to simulate the way a small child learns a first language. Spalding says the trial version is already a hit with the youth at the conference.
Learning the language, and it's almost like in a game. It's a little bit addictive. People stay there and stay there. The response has been fairly good.
Spalding says Inupiaq will be the seventh language Rosetta Stone releases under its Endangered Languages program. He and his team are working with officials around the North Slope on an implementation plan to determine the best use for the software in schools, homes, and other settings. Reporting from Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
November is Native American Heritage Month, and the occasion was marked by a parade through downtown Sitka on Saturday afternoon. KCAW's Ed Ronco met with onlookers gathered before the start of the parade and asked them to reflect on the meaning of heritage.
My name is Heather Powell, and I'm Chukunshaw Eagle Brown Bear. I come from the Cedar House. And Native American Heritage Day is something amazing for us, something that shows that we still have a living culture, something that shows that we're not just something of the past and that we're learning and taking what we know and changing every day. For my own family, things are shining bright. I have a bright light at the end of my tunnel. My son speaks, you know, as much as he speaks English, he's speaking Tlingit already. Can you count for him in Tlingit?
Quick. Dave, nuts, Daku, Cajun.
Tell him what your Tlingit name is.
Daku.
Hi, I'm Stella James, and Native American heritage means to me is my pride. It's where I come from and who I am.
And my name is Sarah Williams. I'm Athabascan. Came from Fort Yukon, Alaska. And I live here for a while. Native American heritage means a lot to me because it's for a Native Alaskan, and it doesn't matter what tribe. It's just for all the Native people.
John Hammock. We celebrate our culture in Southeast, and this is how we show everybody our culture and how much it means to us.
My name is Catherine Nielsen Williams. I'm 80 years old, and I've been in church since.
Do you celebrate heritage?
Oh, all the time in this church. They recognize us all the time. The Russians and Tlingits fought, but they resolved their problems, and they lived together. And they respect our heritage as we do theirs.
Reflections before the start of Saturday's Native American Heritage Month parade, which was organized by the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jake Neer in Barrow, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.